Good morning, everyone. Hope you've had your coffee or whatever you've had this morning. Everybody wide awake? Huh? Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, all right. We're with it. So good to be with you. I was looking back. I came here right before COVID and had a normal meeting. And then COVID hit and I was supposed to come back and did anyway, because somebody figured out we were meeting on, you were meeting on Sunday and Wednesday. You remember that? And I came on Sunday and Wednesday. It's the only time I've ever had a Sunday, skip Monday, Tuesday, come back Wednesday meeting. But we did it and it seemed to work okay. So, I'm glad to be back and just love y'all, all of y'all. Appreciate you. And my wife Julie's with me this morning. It's the only time she can be here is today. But, if you haven't met Julie, I want you to meet her. And our friend Summer is here. Summer is like a daughter to us, right? Yeah, she's like a daughter to us. Love her deeply. Turn in your Bibles, if you will, this morning to John chapter 6. John chapter 6. I want to talk to you in the Bible class hour about something that, well, it's a scene out of the life of Jesus we're all very familiar with. But maybe there's some things here that you haven't seen, or maybe we'll see in a little bit different way. John 6, let's begin the reading in verse 1. After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, or Tiberias. A large crowd followed him because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. Then Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was near. Therefore Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to him, said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread that these may eat?" This he was saying to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are these for so many people?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. Jesus then took the loaves, and having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated, likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing will be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. Therefore, when the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, "This is truly the prophet who has come into the world." The miracles of Jesus were amazing. They were awe-inspiring. Sometimes I think they were head-scratching. And people then, like people today, I'm sure their response would be very much like our response would be from time to time, as we would scratch our heads and say, "How did he do that? How did he do that?" Well, you and I know the answer to that question. He could do that because he was God. And God can do anything. In Genesis 1, the Bible says, "And God said, let there be light." And suddenly every component arrangement of this great effervescence just came into being instantaneously. How? Because God said. And God can do anything. Psalm 33 and verse 6 and Psalm 33 and verse 9 say, "He spoke, done." That's the power of the Word of God. The God who can do anything. Man may have great power. And I think about the advances that we've all made, that mankind has made in the areas of technology and science and medicine and engineering and all of these advances that we enjoy every day and take for granted. But there's nothing that man can do that can possibly equal the power of God. In Hebrews 11 and verse 3, it said, God made something out of nothing. Man can't do that. Only God can do that. Does anybody know the name David Copperfield? Anybody know that name? Who was David Copperfield? Or who is he? I guess he's still living. I don't know. Magician. Magician. You ever go see a magician? I mean a really good one. I'm not talking about the guy that puts a rabbit out of the hat and all that kind of... I'm talking about a really good... Copperfield was one of the best. Copperfield could make a 500-pound tiger appear on stage, whereas before there was not a tiger on stage. And you're looking at that and you're going, how does he do that? How does he do that? Well, there's a difference between magic and miracle. There's a difference between sleight of hand and power of God. When you read in Genesis chapter 1 of the creation of the world out of nothing, that's not sleight of hand. When you read in John chapter 6, Jesus feeding over 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish, that's not sleight of hand. That's not magic. That's miracle. God at work doing something that only God can do. Now, so concerning were the miracles of Jesus that the enemies of Jesus could not dispute them. In fact, the enemies of Jesus said over in John chapter, I think it's 11, beginning verse 47, they said, if we let him continue on like this, everybody's going to believe in him. We can't have that. And so down in John 11, 53, it says, from that day forward, they plotted to kill him. They couldn't deny the miraculous. In their minds, they just needed to take him out. And we know all about that story, don't we? Let's look at the text here in John 6, and then we're going to make some application that maybe will be helpful to all of us. Let's start with the 5,000. Verse 1 begins and says, after these things. I have the New American Standard Version. That's what it says. After these things. Now, writers have a way. Every writer's different. And writers have a way of wording things to keep the narrative moving. To keep the narrative moving. You ever read a book, you get to the end of the chapter, and it's a book of suspense and drama, and you get to the end of the chapter, and what? You're done? Leaves you hanging. You want to turn the page? I'll just read one more. I'm going to read one more. Okay? Writers have a way of kind of hooking you to read more. And sometimes they do it with a phrase, sometimes they do it with a word. Mark, for example, Mark's favorite word, and Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all different, by the way, but Mark's favorite word as a writer is the word immediately. He has the word immediately. I think the old King James may say henceforth, but immediately. And every time you read him, immediately Jesus did this, immediately Jesus went there, immediately, immediately. And it just keeps you moving through the narrative. John is... after these things. You see that in 5:1? John 5:1? After these things. John 6:1? After these things. John 7:1? After these things. So John just has a way of keeping it moving. Now Jesus was with the 12 3+ years. But Matthew and Mark and Luke and John all combined only give us a few brief glimpses into that 3+ years. And you take John, for example. John only talks about 20 days. John only talks about 20 days out of 1,000 days. Out of 1,000 days, give or take, that Jesus is with the 12, John says, here's something that happened on this day, and there's only 20 of them. That's why when you get to the end of the Gospel of John, in chapter 20 of John, and verse 30 and verse 31, he says, many other signs Jesus did, many other miracles Jesus did in the presence of the disciples, and he said, that are not written in this book. I hadn't written about those. But these have been chosen, these have been written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name. Chapter 21 and verse 25, the very last verse in John, there are many other things which Jesus did, which I suppose if they were written in detail, not even the world itself could contain the books that could be written. 20 days out of 1,000. Now here's what's interesting. This feeding of the 5,000. All four of these writers talk about this miracle. All four chronicle this one, which says something important was happening here. That they all four do that. So let's look at the text. Verse 1. After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, or Tiberias. By the way, that's a real place. The Bible talks about real people and real places, real events. You can go there today. You can see that. The Sea of Galilee, we get this mindset because we call it a sea, that it's this like ocean body of water, and that's not true. The Sea of Galilee is about 13 miles long, 8 miles across. We would call it a lake. In fact, sometimes in the text it calls it a lake. Lake Gennesaret was another name for it. On the northern end of the Sea of Galilee was gigantic Mount Hermon, snow-capped 9 months out of the year. The snow melts from Mount Hermon at about 10,000 feet elevation, and then flows down into the, feeds the northern edge of the Sea of Galilee. And then on the southern end of the Sea of Galilee, the outflow is one of the most famous rivers in the Bible, and that's the Jordan. So it's a very important place, biblically. So that's where Jesus is. He goes away to the other side of the sea. But verse 2, a large crowd followed him. Look at the end of verse 2. Why are they following him? Anybody? Why are they following him? They saw signs. They saw miracles. Word about him was spreading. Matthew chapter 4 says, the news about Jesus spread throughout Jerusalem and Judea, Galilee, as far as Syria, it says. So people are coming to him. They're hearing about all of this. Now verse 3. Jesus went up on a mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now, this is where it helps to compile Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, put all the pieces together, because John skips something here, but Matthew doesn't. Matthew fills in the gap between verses 2 and 3. In Matthew 14 and verse 13, look at the gap that Matthew fills in. Matthew 14, verse 13. When Jesus heard about John the Baptizer, heard what? What had Herod done to him in the previous verses, beginning in verse 1? Beheaded him. And so when Jesus heard about John, he withdrew from there in a boat to a secluded place by himself. But when the people heard of this, they followed him on foot from the cities. So you can just think about getting this horrific news that the one person who knows you better than anybody else has not just passed away, but has been brutally murdered by this wicked Herod. And so Jesus in the flesh, like us, needed some time to process. He needed some time to think, pray, talk to the 12, grieve. When you need to grieve, what are you looking for? What do you need? What?
Privacy.
When we want to grieve, we're not asking for a bunch of people just to gather around us. And we just kind of want to get off to ourselves. We want to grieve. So Jesus makes an obvious attempt to get away and leave all these people who've been following Him and coming to Him. Because He needed some time to grieve. He needed some time to talk to the 12. But He makes an obvious attempt to get away from people. Do we sometimes need to do that? That's not a trick question. Yes, we do. You ever have a Saturday planned? Maybe you've been working like crazy and you've had all this stuff and it's just finally like you just can't wait for Saturday to get here. You're like, you know, I'm not going to do anything Saturday. I just want to decompress. I just want to get away from everything. Whew, catch my breath. Relax. Okay. And so you got it all planned out. And about 8 o'clock Saturday morning, there's a knock on your door. It's your next door neighbor. And your next door neighbor says, "Hey, Matthew, I've got a plumbing issue. I know you're good at that. It only take about 10 minutes. You ever heard that? It only take you about 10 minutes. What does that mean? Translate. It's going to take the rest of the day. What? It's going to take all day long. You're going to have to go back and forth to the hardware store because you got the wrong thing the first time. It's going to take all day long. So you've planned out some rest. You got more stuff to do. It just happens. Sometimes it just happens. Okay? And it happened here. Look in verse 5. Jesus lifted up his eyes and he sees what? Coming to him. All these people. Now keep in mind, he's got in a boat, went to the other side of Galilee, the Sea of Galilee, looking for some time away. The last thing he needed was the first thing he got, more people. And he looks at the crowd. And with Jesus' typical compassion, says what? What's he thinking about? Huh? How are we going to feed these people? And who does he ask that, by the way? Verse 5. Philip. He asks Philip, he says, how are we going to, we got to feed these people. How are we going to feed these people? You know, it's interesting to make a Bible study of the questions God asks. The first question God ever asked was in Genesis when the Bible says, walked in the garden in the cool of the evening and he calls out to the first man and woman. He says, "Where are you?" Question. Did he not know? Did God not know where they were? Then why did he ask the question? Make them think about where they were. That's exactly right. But that's the way it is with all the questions of God. It's the same with the questions of Jesus. Jesus is not asking Philip this question because Jesus needs information. Jesus is asking Philip this question because he's trying to grow Philip's faith. He's trying to grow Philip's faith. Now, 5,000 people, a lot of people. Probably more, a lot more than that because just the men were 5,000. So there were a lot of people. Philip, where are we going to get enough food to feed these people? There was a Bible class. One little boy raised his hand. He had to answer. He said, "Why didn't he just send them to Chick-fil-A?" And the little girl spoke up and says, "Because they're closed on Sunday." I love teaching Bible classes and I love teaching the little kids because you never know. You just never know what you're going to hear, you know. I wasn't teaching one quarter and one teacher got sick or had car trouble or something on the way last minute and needed a teacher. And I said, "I'll do it. I'm not teaching." "Well, they're 4 and 5 year olds." "Oh, that's okay. No big deal." So I went in there with 4 and 5 year olds and I'm teaching, and just spur of the moment, and I'm just trying to teach them this lesson about God, you know, and how God is everywhere and there's nowhere God isn't, just something simple and basic. And I said, is there anywhere where God isn't? This little boy raised his hand. I know a place, he said. I said, you know somewhere where God isn't? He said, yeah. I said, where? He said, New Jersey. I said, what? He said, New Jersey. I said, what do you mean? He says, because my dad went there last week on business and he said it was a God-forsaken place. I assured him I'd been to New Jersey and God was there too. I mean, but you never know. You never know what kids are gonna say, you know? So they ask him, Jesus asked the question like we ask. Where are we gonna get food for all these people? Now let's look at the food. Beginning of verse 6. He was saying this to test him, for he himself knew what he was gonna do. See, Jesus is challenging Philip on Philip's behalf. He wanted Philip to be able to say, Lord, we've been with you this long. We've seen you do these miracles. We believe in you. There's not a thing you cannot do because we believe you are God. That's what Jesus was hoping Philip would conclude. Lord, I believe, as we sing. That didn't happen. Verse 7, Philip answered and said, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them for everyone to receive a little. You kind of read between the lines. Jesus looks at Philip. Philip looks at Judas. Why? Why would Philip look at Judas? Judas is the treasurer. Judas would know how much money they had. So Jesus asks Philip the question, and you almost see Philip going, and Judas saying, no. So Philip comes back to Jesus and says, we've got some money, but we don't have that much. Not enough. And then optimistic Andrew speaks up, verse 8, verse 9. Andrew found a food source. Little kid. Probably out fishing for the day or whatever. How much food did he have, verse 9? How much food? 5 loaves, 2 fish. Okay, 5 loaves, 2 fish. Andrew is so optimistic. But sometimes optimism meets reality, right? Optimism meets reality, and even Andrew had to conclude, it's not enough. So Philip looks in the purse and says it's not enough. Andrew looks in the pantry and says it's not enough. The problem was, neither Philip or Andrew or anybody else looked where? To Jesus. That's exactly right. So in verse 10, Jesus said, have the people go away. Is that what he says?
No.
That's not what it says? Sit down. Have the people sit down. Again, it's always interesting to me to compare the writers and how the personalities of each writer shines forth. Mark is so detailed. Mark is the master. He's always painting. Talk about a writer painting a picture. Mark loves to paint pictures in color. Mark says they sat down on the green grass. He didn't say they sat down on the grass. They sat down on the green grass. And then he talks about how Jesus had them all set in groups of 50 over here and 100 over there. And so there was some kind of organization to all of this. Verse 11. Jesus takes the loaves and gave thanks, and then he distributed to those who were seated. Likewise of the fish, how much? Much as they wanted. Buffet. Much as they wanted. Verse 12, when they were filled, he said to the disciples, gather up the fragments that nothing be lost. And verse 13, how many baskets filled with fragments did they gather? How many baskets? Why 12? What? 12 apostles who are struggling to put all the pieces together. And 12 apostles, each one's carrying a basket filled with leftover food. Thinking what? Yeah. How did he do that? So Philip is scratching his head. Andrew is scratching his head. Matthew and Thomas, and all, they're all scratching their heads going, why? My favorite, though, is the one that I'd like to know a little bit more about, and that's the little boy whose mom had packed him a lunch that day. He's got to go home with his lunchbox and say, Mama, you ain't going to believe this. You know? What a story he had to tell. But verse 14 ends, there's no denying the public nature of these miracles. The people concluded from all of this, this is truly the prophet who is to come into the world. Okay. Now then, I'm not going to give you 12 basketfuls to go home. I tell you what, I am going to give you a to-go box. So I'm going to put five things in your to-go box that I learned from this, that I get out of this. I'm sure there's plenty more, but five things that I learned from this. So get your to-go box ready. Maybe make some notes. Five things I want you to take home with you from this message out of John 6. Number one, compassion. Compassion trumps convenience. Compassion trumps convenience. Jesus loved people when it wasn't convenient to love people. He wanted rest time. He wanted grieving time. What he got was more people who infringed upon his time. But then again, if you and I are going to be servants, that's not always convenient, is it? Because inherent in the idea of serving is the principle of sacrifice. And sacrifice is means I give up something, you give up something for another. Compassion trumps convenience. You know, it's easier to be critical than it is to be compassionate. It just is. Criticism makes you more like a judge. Compassion makes you more like Jesus. Go for the compassion. That's what I get out of this. Go for the compassion. Number two, God can turn a bad situation. God can turn a bad situation into a good opportunity. Romans 8 and verse 28. God causes all things to work together for what? Good. To those who love God and to those who are called according to His purpose. We see that in the lives of Bible characters, Old Testament and New Testament. But I think if you look at your life, you can see it in yours too. It's called providence. And the word providence is one of those words that defines itself. In other words, the definition of providence is in the word providence. What word is in there? Provide. Providence is God's way of providing for us. The question is, are you available? That's always been the question. Are you available? Even are you available to be inconvenienced like Jesus was? You know, there's two ways to say, here am I, send me. Moses said, here am I, send me, but I'd rather you send Aaron. But Isaiah said, here am I, send me. Isaiah said, I'm available. I am available. Send me. Number three, God can take your little and make a lot. God can take your little and make a lot. Five loaves, two fish isn't very much. But God has a way of multiplying your little. And the key is to let God do the math. Let God do the math. Let God figure it out. You and I just have to be available. You and I just have to use what He has placed in our hands. And it may be time, it may be talent and ability, it may be opportunity, but you just have to be available. Let God do the math. He's better at it than all of us put together. Number four, nothing is too big for God. Nothing is too big for God. How many times and how many stories do we have to look at to finally get it? We can't take the land. There's giants in the land. They must be too big for God. Joshua and Caleb didn't think that. By the way, we meet at 5, is that right? Tonight at 5, I want to talk to you about my hero in the Old Testament. Because my hero in the Old Testament was Caleb. Caleb. And when people ask me the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be like Caleb. We're going to talk about 85-year-old Caleb tonight. What an example. But Joshua and Caleb knew that God was bigger than any giants in the land. Or David and Goliath. I mean, if you just put it down on paper, David and Goliath isn't much of a match. Until you start figuring out. I do a series of sermons on David and Goliath. And I love this scene because I think sometimes we misunderstand some things. If on a football field, you're going to put a lineman. Are linemen big guys? Real big guys? Yeah. So you got this lineman out here who's 6'5 and he weighs 330, right? He's big. And then you got this running back who's 5'10. You know, I don't know what he weighs, but it doesn't matter because he's fast and quick. And you put this lineman out here and you put this running back out here. And you give the running back the ball and you separate them by about 10 yards and you say, go. And the running back takes off for the end zone, and the only one between himself and the end zone is that lineman. Who's going to win that battle every time? Why? Quicker. Quicker. All of the soldiers in David and Saul's army hadn't figured that out. And David said, give me the ball. Because David was also a thrower, a slinger. The Old Testament talks about slingers. David was a slinger. He had lots of practice because he'd been out with the sheep. So this man, even as a young man, had become quite adept at slinging. But he was also a lot smaller, quicker, faster. And the battle proceeded, and well, we know what happened. David said, Lord, battle's yours. Jericho walls makes no sense. Marched around, 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 around. Anybody know how many times he marched around? Count them up. 13 times. They marched around 13 times. I think most of us would have given up after 5 or 6. Think about all that walking, all the people making fun of you, and you're like, again? We got to go around again? 13 times. And the walls fell down flat. 5,000 people. 5 loaves, 2 fish. Big deal. It's amazing what God can do when you give Him your little. There's nothing too big for Him. And last point, our faith must conquer our fear. Our faith must conquer our fear. The problem is we're just like Andrew, we're just like Philip. We think the solution is up to us. We've got this issue up here that's a lot bigger than me. I can't handle it. Don't know what to do. That's Andrew and Philip right there. The solution is not up to me or you. At some point, we just have to trust God and put it in His hands. Philippians 4 verse 13 says, I can, not can't, I can do all things. And it doesn't end there. I've heard people quote Philippians 4:13. I can do all things. It doesn't say that. It says what? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Who gets the glory and the credit? Christ does. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. Our faith has to conquer our fear. And there's tons of application for that. Does anybody have anything they want to add before we close? The feeding of the 5,000. There's so much there. So many points of application. We've only touched on just a little bit of it this morning. But I appreciate your time, and I thank you for the kind way you've listened. Thank you so much.
Brother Adam.
Yes.